Vince Band on the Titanic, sing dear my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard bow, won't you dance with me?
The dockside, saying, please, son, don't take this trip. I said, mama, sweet mama, don't you worry none. Even God couldn't sink this ship. Well, the whistle blew, and they turned the screws. It turned the water into foam. Destination, sweet salvation. Goodbye, home, sweet home. I'm in the dance band. Titanic, sing near my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard bow, won't you dance with me? There was a trombone and a saxophone. The bass and drums were cooking on the bandstand, and I was strumming in the middle with his dude on a fiddle, and we were 3 days out. Shout down, there's icebergs around, but still everything's alright. Oh, the dance band on the Titanic, sing near my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard bow, won't you dance with me? They were burning all the flares for candles, in the banquet they were throwing in first class. Blowing waltzes in a ballroom when the universe went crash. Children and chaplains first. Well, they soon used up all of the lifeboats, but there were a lot of us left on board. I heard the drummer saying, boys, just keep playing, now we're doing this deed for the Lord. I heard the dance band on the tide sing near my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard.
And good morning. A little gala's humor for us here this morning on Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, as usual, Paul Roland. Got another Paul on the line with us to talk about just how bad is the climate situation, and do we really want to know? Kind of an odd question, you might think. We're going to get into all that with Paul Beckwith, who's a physicist, engineer, and now a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa. He is in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change, and lots more about him, which we can talk about in the next hour. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Paul.
So what do you think of that song?
Yeah, I think it's rather fitting. You know, I think one of the very common jokes you hear is that human actions against climate change are like shuffling chairs on the deck of the Titanic, right? In other words, we're not doing things that will change our direction of the ship, steer it away from the iceberg.
Yeah, and actually, it was interesting on alternative radio, which aired yesterday on KBOO, Robert Hackett, who was did a whole hour on climate change in the media, interesting show, used that analogy fairly extensively, actually. So I just had to use that song. So let's get right into it. You were on just about a year ago. The theme of that show was also very provocative. Too late or not too late? Is that the question? And give us an overview of just a quick sketch of what you see as the major drivers of climate change, the major developments that are affecting climate change, the major things to look for on the global scale.
Well, the Arctic is really the sort of the crux of the matter. So the Arctic is still warming extremely rapidly because there's lots of feedbacks that make it warm faster than the rest of the planet. So it's we're losing the Arctic Ocean sea ice cover. It's dropping exponentially. Its extent is getting smaller. Its area, its volume, you know, it's rapidly vanishing on a very rapid trend, which reaches zero somewhere around 2020, you know, maybe 2021, 2022. So the next 3 to 5 years, if the trend continues. This year, we're at a record low state right now. We have been for lots of the year because the ice didn't form as strongly as it would in the winter. So it's a lot thinner. It's mostly first-year ice. It's not old ice, and first-year ice is laced with brine pockets, saltwater pockets, so it's more honeycombed, and it's not as strong as the older ice. So there's very little older ice there. We're also losing snow cover on the land around the Arctic in spring at an even faster rate than the sea ice. So it's getting much darker up in the Arctic. There's less white ice and snow that reflects light. There's darker ocean, darker permafrost. It's getting darker, so it's still heating up at a great rate. Now, this is a problem on a number of different fronts. First of all, the jet streams that circle the Earth and guide weather patterns are formed because of the temperature difference between the equator and the Arctic. So as the Arctic is warming much faster than elsewhere, it's lowering that temperature difference to the equator, so the jet streams are becoming slower and wavier, and we're getting an increase in extreme weather events like torrential rains leading to floods that we're seeing, or droughts in other regions, or, you know, extreme wind storms. Because it's warmer, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that's fueling these intense storms. Now, Greenland is sitting up in the Arctic, and the melt rates of Greenland are increasing rapidly. A recent paper came out on that. And in this year in particular, there's tremendous amounts of calving of ice off the glaciers of Greenland going into the ocean and being carried down past Newfoundland, interrupting shipping and so on there. Of course, we're also seeing heat waves, as many people in parts of Texas and elsewhere know, 122 degree Fahrenheit temperatures, and it's only June. That's 50 degrees Celsius for metric people. CO2 levels are set record high rates of rise in 2016 and 2015, about 3 parts per million, which is double what it would have been just typical rates a decade ago. And temperatures have gone up tremendous amounts. And it's very important to talk about temperatures in terms of relative to pre-industrial, which is 1750, because that's what the IPCC Paris numbers were all about. That 2 degrees Celsius rise is relative to 1750. So to give you an idea of how close we are, for 2016, the average global annual temperature was 1.44 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. For the month of February, when we were into the El Nino, it was at 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial for that month. So all of the indications from climate are heading very rapidly upwards in the wrong direction and will destabilize humans and cause great infrastructure damage. And, of course, methane is the wild card. There's been a lot of work in the news about methane, recent measurements, recent papers, et cetera, on the sea, coming up from the seafloor in the Arctic Ocean.
You want to say anything about the Antarctic?
Yes. Yeah, so the Antarctic, people are watching Larsen Sea, which is a very large ice shelf coming off the Antarctica Peninsula. and there's a crack in Larsen's Sea, and it's about a big chunk of ice. I think that is comparable to the state of Delaware for a size comparison, is about to break off from the ice shelf on Larsen's Sea. That's about 10% of the ice shelf. Now, in the past, we saw Larsen A, collapse quite quickly. The ice went on that shelf, broke up into icebergs, which floated away. And the same thing happened with Larsen B a number of years ago. So Larsen C is destabilizing, and the both Antarctica and Greenland are melt rates of, so that's ice on land that's melting, which raises sea level rise. So sea level rise is ever faster because of the additional heat going into the ocean, hot water expands, and also because of the water from the melting ice caps on Antarctica and Greenland.
And from what I understand, one of the major issues with the ice shelves breaking off is they themselves don't cause additional sea level rise because they're already floating, but they're sort of preventing further melting further inland. They're sort of a buttress in a certain sense for the ice cap there. Is that your understanding?
Yes, as long as there's large ice sheets there, you know, they're continuously calving at the edges where they meet the ocean, like the edge of the ice sheet, and they're floating, as you say, and they're attached to ice, which is on the shore, which isn't floating. So as long as they're there, the flow rates of ice flows. It takes time under gravity. The immense weight that builds up from 3 kilometers of ice, it flows downhill. And when we lose an ice shelf, then the rate of the flow off the land increases. So we saw that with Larsen A, where that was joined, and with Larsen B, and we're seeing it, in Greenland as well. So it happens all over. And some of these ice shelves they're called retrograde beds, where as you go deeper underneath the ice shelf, the ocean floor gets deeper and deeper. It slopes downwards. So the more melting you get, that will increase the rate of melting too. So we're seeing all of these things happen.
And of course,
simultaneously.
Another thing that's happening is the glaciers. A recent article by Dar Jamil, who's doing some of the foremost journalism on climate change in the world, I think. Scientists predict there will be no glaciers in the contiguous U.S. by 2050, but Trump is stomping on the gas pedal. And want to say a thing about the glaciers?
Yeah, I mean, the glaciers... So there's glaciers, of course. Generally, they're at higher elevations. So, for example, in the Rocky Mountains, the Sierra Nevada, the glaciers up there feed a lot of the rivers that run into, both run into California and run out into the, Midwest of the U.S. And also, the Himalayan glaciers, the water runoff. So glaciers basically store, it's this form of storage of water. As you get more and more snow on the glaciers, then the ice builds up over time. And you also, at the other side of the coin, you get the melt from the glaciers, and that acts as the source of many rivers, which, in Asia, are responsible for the livelihoods of for a billion people that are farming, etc. And that water is very important for irrigation and things like that. The same thing, with not so many people, the Rocky Mountains, but those glaciers feed the rivers which run through both the US and Canada and recharge lakes and things like that. So as these glaciers lose mass, it will really change. If there's no source of a river's not going to be there. River's going to dry up. So we have all these wrenching changes which will affect, I don't think anybody on the planet will be unaffected by what's happening with climate change. Many people are starting to become aware of this now, but there's still nowhere near enough, and there's certainly the political action to deal with it is going in the opposite direction. I mean, I would argue, and I have been for a while, that all signs of our changing, rapidly changing climate indicate that we have a climate change emergency on our hands, and we have to deal with emergencies, with this emergency, as we do with any other emergency. For a start, you know, let people know how dire the situation is, and then look at what action can we take, what can we do. I've just purchased a new book that was just published, and it's called Drawdown. It's edited by Paul Hawken, and it was just published this year. It's 100 different substantive solutions to attempt to, you know, reverse global warming, reduce emissions, and actually remove carbon dioxide from the air. And I don't think it goes as far as, you know, ways to actually cause cooling, because there are techniques under the umbrella called solar radiation management to allow cooling to occur. So, but we, you know, the world needs to just wake up. I mean, this is an extremely serious situation. It's become so politicized that you know, human action humans are sort of in turmoil on this issue. I mean, you have all the scientists, and you have people that recognize how grave the problem is, and then on the other hand, you have, you know, lots of politicians who are saying, you know, they don't even acknowledge that it's happening. So, you know, it's a very bizarre situation. I mean, the old movie, The Twilight Zone, comes to mind, you know.
Yeah, we talked about that in our first show a year ago. And I want to talk about addressing the situation with climate change further on in the program. But I want to get a little deeper into it. You talked about a lot of articles. I could read the titles of a number of articles that come out. Early Stage Antarctica Death Rattle Sparks New York Times Journalist Trip. It's the End of the World and We Know It. Scientists in Many Disciplines See Apocalypse Soon. Anyway, I go on and on. But the one I wanted to, I have a link to on my program page at kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio that I really wanted to get into is this subsea permafrost on East Siberian Arctic Shelf in accelerated decline. You know, because even that the headline by Dar Jamel, scientists predict there will be no glaciers by 2050. You hear words like 2050, 2100. You know, in 20 years, in 30 years, there's a lot of people are continuing to sort of push into the future the various effects and even various responses to climate change, including the whole global IPCC protocols and the various agreements that either have been signed or attempted to be signed. But there's these wild cards, which seem to be less and less wild cards, which you refer to the methane, and the seems to be the largest reservoir of methane is there in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And this article just came out in Nature Communication Journal by Dr. Natalia Shakova and Dr. Igor Semilatov. I don't know if both of them, but I know she's with the International Arctic Research Center connected to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So you want to talk about this article and its implications?
Yes. So this is an extremely significant article. And Nick Breeze, who is a personal friend of mine, has done a wonderful job he had an interview with Shakova shortly after the paper came out, and he just released that the transcript of the interview recently, and also some videos. I found that a lot more actually came out in the interview in addition to what was in the paper. So first, what was in the paper, which is very significant, is the Russians have been drilling holes in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf from ships for many years. So they have some drill cores going back to over 30 years ago. So they could drill down and they could measure how deep in the sediment there was frozen permafrost. And 30 years later, they're back. So just, you know, in the last few years, they've drilled through those same regions, and they found that the permafrost layers are much further in the sediments now. In fact, I'll convert to feet, but it's about 4.2 meters or something further down, which is about multiplied by 3.3, so that's about 13 feet or so. So the frozen permafrost is now found deeper and deeper in the sediments, and the reason why that is happening is because the water is warmer and the water is thawing out the, you know, it's above zero, of course, and in the last 5 years, 10 years, it's got a lot warmer. This is the sea floor is shallow on this continental shelf. It's only 50 meters deep. And then, so, you know, in those sediments underneath the seafloor, there's this layer of permafrost, and that was thought to be sort of a cap and prevent methane from coming up. But what they've been measuring is that there's large amounts of methane that are now coming up. So on the seafloor, so the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf is huge. It's a vast shelf. It's like 2 million square kilometers. To give you an idea, you know, the maximum sea ice extent in the whole Arctic is about 14 million square kilometers, you know, in the winter. And in the summer, you know, as it's been melting out, the values are down to about 6 million square kilometers or something like that, or 5. So that's sort of ballpark. So it's a huge area we're talking about. It's about 50 meters deep on average, which is, that's about 160, 170 feet deep. And about 10% of that whole area of the shelf is showing methane release bubbling up. It's called, I think, Shakova in the paper, they referred to it as hot zones or hot areas. And this was also, you know, this was explained a lot more in the questions that Nick Breeze was asking. So there's those 10% areas of the shelf, there's high concentrations of methane being measured in the atmosphere just above the surface of the water and also in the water column. Now, when you compare the concentrations of methane to that in the other 90% of the shelf, the hot areas have about 1,000 to 100,000 times more methane in those regions than they do in the background regions. Now, also, the paper was showing, and in the interview was showing, that it's not just the methane clath rates, which is when water freezes and traps methane in the center, and then when the water thaws, like a cage, then the methane will be released, expand 160 times in volume from the ice, and then cause pressure. And that's caused blowholes to come in the Siberian permafrost above the seafloor. So we're seeing these similar blowholes on the ocean floor. We're seeing areas where the seafloor is sort of bubbling up, but the sediments haven't been broken through yet from the methane. And we're also seeing lots of emissions from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf. But it's not just the clath rates that have the methane. There's also methane in the sediments as well. So there's huge amounts there. Something like 1% of the clath rates were released to the atmosphere. That would double the level of methane that's presently in the atmosphere today.
And let me just pause. I'm speaking with Paul Beckwith, a climate systems scientist up in Ottawa, Canada, and he's my guest this morning on Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. My name's Paul Rowland. This is a talk show, and I will finally give out the number for you to call in and ask questions and make your comments. It's 503-231-8187. To engage on this oh-so-important subject. So So how did this methane form initially?
Okay, so the sea level, about 21,000 years ago, there was so much ice on, you know, still on Greenland and Antarctica, but the ice spread down across North America as far as St. Louis. You know, up where I am near Ottawa, the ice was about 1.5 kilometers thick over Ottawa. So as you'd go further and further south, you know, it would have been a bit thinner. But that's the Laurentian ice sheet covering Canada. Over in Europe, we had this massive ice sheet covering, you know, and it actually covered Britain, it covered all of Europe. And of course, with all that ice, all that water tied up in the ice, the sea levels were lower. They were about 120 to 130 meters lower. So that meant that the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf would be about 70 to 80 meters above sea level, and the ground would be very cold, and that would allow the ground to be frozen and forming the permafrost. And the longer it was open for, exposed to the air, the more permafrost there was that could be formed. Then as the end of the last ice age ended and the ice melted, the sea levels rose, and when they rose up to that level, they rose to the level of the shelf, and they kept rising. So now the shelf is 50 meters under the sea level. So that's how the permafrost got there. Some of it was formed, you know, in the last ice age, and there'd be some formed in previous ice ages before that. And actually, some of it's been dated to go back to about 2.5 million years. Some of the methane that is coming out of the Arctic was actually from permafrost that was frozen 2.5 million years ago. So it's very old permafrost. Some was formed just as recently as, you know, maybe 5,000 years ago or something. So, you know, when at the point up until the sea rose enough to cover the continental shelf.
And the methane itself was obviously formed by organic matter over, you know, same time period, millions of years.
Yes. Yeah, so when the ground freezes, you know, that's there's lots of organic material that is laid down in the soils, etc., from trees that have grown there, from carcasses of animals, from excrement of animals. So there's lots of organic material, and that freezes in the permafrost. So it doesn't decompose while it's frozen, but when it's thawed out, then it will decompose. And if there's no oxygen available, which is the case deep under the ground, it forms methane. When the bacteria decomposes organic material, it forms methane. So the methane then can either get frozen if the pressure is high enough and the temperature is low enough into these clathrate forms, or the methane can just exist as a gas in those conditions, because the key factor is as you go deeper and deeper into the ground, the temperature rises. So you go deep enough into the ground and the temp is too warm for methane to exist in a frozen form or for permafrost to exist. And of course, as you go nearer and nearer the surface, it depends on what latitude you are and what the daily or the mean annual temperature is as to whether or not you have permafrost or not. So you start with continuous permafrost in the high north, and as you go south and you go to discontinuous permafrost where there's pockets of unfrozen ground, and then you go to sporadic permafrost further south, you know, where it's kind of in different, some regions have it, some don't, and then you go to no permafrost. So as you go even further south, so you have these different regimes of permafrost. So this is and one of the big concerns is that normally when you have, like, if you go up to the Arctic, you have the permafrost regions, and as those are warming, you get thawing of some of the permafrost, and then you get these lakes forming, and then the heat from the lakes actually thaws more permafrost in the ground underneath the lake, so on the lake bed. So imagine that environment now being inundated with seawater, and now you have these these pockets, which used to be lakes with taliks, which are areas of unfrozen ground underneath them, and now suddenly it's covered by seawater. Say 5,000 years ago, in the case of the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf, the sea level is rising. So now what happens is that now it was believed that the cold water, seawater freezes at minus 1.8 degrees Celsius at typical salinity levels, salt levels in the ocean. So that water, it was thought that that water would cause those taliks under the lake to freeze, and you'd have, you know, you'd have like a cap, sort of a frozen cap, preventing methane in gaseous form below from coming up and escaping. And now that it's not such a clear picture that that was the case. When a region is inundated with water, with warm water, then the permafrost can start thawing, and you could have methane released over time. But then, you know, it would be the methane near the surface that's released. So that if that was a continuous process, then there's less there. But the difference now between now and is that, you know, we've had this warming period for quite a long period of time, and the warming has greatly accelerated in the last decade or so. So the problem is once you get a pathway opening up through the permafrost so that the methane gas can escape, then it's going to keep bubbling up until the gas pocket has been exhausted. So, you know, if we cooled the Arctic, you know, we couldn't just close up that particular nozzle. So we're still going to get cooling the Arctic. We're still going to get some methane coming up until it exhausts the pockets that are open, and then hopefully the rest of it should stay down. So you can see the time, the urgency of time in this equation, because if we wait and wait and wait and do nothing, and we get tremendous thawing of all this permafrost, then we can't stop this methane from coming up, and it will rocket our planet to a much warmer temperature very quickly because methane is so powerful. So we're releasing the genie from the methane bottle, if you like, in the Arctic. And it's not just the methane class rates. It's all of the methane that's in gas form as well. So we have a huge problem. I mean, what we've done, the difference between this between now and previous warm periods is those previous warm periods weren't as long. Like the Eemian, which was the previous interglacial about 140,000 years ago, the temperature went higher than it is today and then dropped, and that was in the space of just a couple thousand years. And so, you know, if we were to be able to drop the temperature up in the Arctic, you know, we could keep a lot of the methane from perforating and from coming out, perforating the permafrost. But, you know, if we have, I mean, we're going the other way at a very rapid rate. We're warming at rates, you know, 10 or 20 or 40 times faster than we've seen happen naturally in previous historical climate records. So,
well, you've raised a lot of stuff, and I have some further questions and clarifications. But we do have a listener who has a question or comment. I believe it's Jenny. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I have a question. I'm wondering, I've been following the stuff going on up in Yellowstone, and just let my mind wander, and I was wondering if it's possible that the heating up of the Earth is coming partly from the inside, because you were talking about the triple calderas, and I'm sure you know all this has been in the news in how it has an effect on the entire planet. And if it has an effect on climate change, and if that's just another avenue that it might be contributing to.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, okay. So generally, there's not connections. There's not huge connections between the geological things happening and climate things happening, but there are definitely some connections. In fact, Bill McGuire has written a whole book on this topic. For example, when we have very rapid rates of ice melt that have happened in the past, for example, leaving the last ice age, that incredible weight being lifted off the surface of the Earth caused the Earth stresses in the Earth to be released and caused an uptick or an increased number of earthquakes during those periods of time. So we're seeing this sort of thing in places like Alaska, where there's very rapid glacier melt. There's less weight on the land because the glaciers melt, the water runs off, the land then uplifts quickly, and there can be these small earthquakes. Generally, they're small ice quakes, they call them. If you have torrential rains and that causes a landslide on the side of a volcano, for example, then that earth leaving the volcano can relieve the pressure. If the volcano was primed to go, it could then erupt. So there's those type of connections. The Yellowstone tremors, I think we have to be a bit careful. The core of the earth is not really heating up, as I can tell. I mean, the heating in the core is from radioactive decay, and that's a very steady process over millennia, over thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years sort of thing. You know, and that heat in the core is also related to continental drift and things like that, and we're not seeing, you know, large changes in rates of continental drift and things like that.
So,
but one thing that we are doing is we've created all earthquake surges in Oklahoma, for example, from fracking. I mean, what do we expect? We pour a lubricant into the fault line that lubricates it. Rock can slide past each other easier. We get earthquakes in a place where we never had them before, and some of them can get quite large.
But essentially,
in
relation to our question, there's the heating that's going on in the Earth's climate has no relation to the magma deep in the Earth.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
So, I just want to throw this out there. I mean, one, because of the extremity of what's happening, one's mind can go to strange places. So, you know, one finds oneself thinking, well, maybe if the Yellowstone caldera blows, it will, you know, cool the earth enough and slow down industrial processes so that maybe we can, that'll save us from this, the apocalypse of global warming. But I know these are ridiculous thoughts that we should do our best to suppress. But getting back to the situation in the East Iberian Arctic shelf. Are there estimates of how much methane is there, and how much methane could potentially be released, and in what space of time it could be released?
Well, there's 5 billion tons of methane in the atmosphere today. Okay, that's a billion. That is the that's giga. Mega is a million. Giga is a billion. So that's 5 gigatons of methane in the atmosphere today. The methane class rates across the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf can extend down to a couple hundred meters in thickness. They don't start right at the surface. They can start deep down under the seafloor, and where the conditions are suitable for them to be stable up to now, and that can be a couple hundred meters of thickness. So if 1% of those class rates, the methane is released from 1% of those class rates, that would add another 5 gigatons of methane to the atmosphere. So that would double our level of methane in the atmosphere. Now,
and what would that do?
That would cause a large spike in temperatures. It would cause the temperatures to go up extremely quickly, because the methane lifetime on average in the atmosphere is about 12 years. And on a 20-year average time scale, methane is more powerful a greenhouse gas than the CO2 molecule by 86 times. On a few-year time scale, it's more like 150 or 200 times. So if the methane comes up quickly, it will cause a great warming. And in fact, there's a paper, and I believe it's accessible to the public. It's from a few years ago. Peter Wadhams was involved in it. They looked at what would happen if 50 gigatons of methane was released, either over, you know, in 1 year or 5 gigatons a year for 10 years. And they did a study on that, and they found that the economic impact to the global economy was something like $77 trillion, according to their study. It was Peter Wadhams, the sea ice guy from the UK, and also an economist who they were trying to get numbers on what would sort of happen. So if you read the Shakova interview from that Nick Breeze had, the transcripts, she's talking about that 1% release, and she's also talking about saying that, hey, there's a lot more methane down there than even what's in the clath rates. It's not just the clath rates. You know, people may have heard the term methane clath rate gun, the idea that the clath rates would release the methane very quickly. There's lots of methane locked in the frozen permafrost, right? Not the clath rates, it's in the permafrost. And, you know, when the permafrost thaws, that methane will be released. And that permafrost in some regions of Siberia goes down many, many kilometers. There's also pockets of methane gas where the methane that are trapped in the ground, and if there's pathways, those can go up through the earth. So we need a frozen Arctic. So in order to, you know, to counter this risk.
So I just wanted. We only have 15 minutes left, and there's still a lot to cover. And we do have a caller who I will go to in just a second. But just so this question of when this could possibly happen. I mean, I know people are very loath to say. I think Shakova actually came a lot closer than I've seen climate scientists come to saying that it virtually could come at any time. Almost. I mean, what's your best guess? I mean, are we talking about, you know, still like 20, 30 years? Are we talking about within 5 years? Are we talking about could it happen this summer?
Well, the risk of it happening is ever increasing. You know, it increases year to year as we continue, as the Arctic continues this incredibly fast warming. So, yes, it could happen. You know, at any time, and that could is getting bigger and bigger every year, and eventually, you know, will turn into a will happen, right? And happens, and this is a like Shakova. This is, you know, climate scientists are getting very emotional about this. You know, they're not their objective. They're humans like everybody else. You know, many of them have kids. You know, we all have lives on this planet. We can't ignore this problem and hope it will go away. We can't, you know, we have to fight back against people that say climate change is not occurring and ignoring climate change. We have to do it as if our lives, our children's lives depend on it, and our children's children's lives, and maybe even our lives. I mean, look, I mean, the trend in the Arctic is that we have no sea ice covering the entire Arctic Ocean in 2020, 2022, you know, in the next 3 to 5 years. That's the trend. If the trend turns around, it will last longer. The problem is that the models that the policymakers and governments are using are the IPCC models, and they're projecting that the sea ice would last much longer till 2040, 2050. The problem is those models are not incorporating all of the physics of what is happening. They're only incorporating things that we knew about. And, of course, climate change is happening much faster than expected. Our expectations on how fast climate change is happening are completely out to lunch. We need to change our expectations, reboot them, and look at what is happening, you know, in reality, on the ground, not what is predicted by some model. So when we lose sea ice in the Arctic, of course, it takes a lot of energy to melt ice. And that energy will now heat the seawater instead of melting the ice. So the temperature, the rate of temperature rise in the Arctic will go much, much higher when we start having no sea ice at the end of the year, like at the end, you know, September, end of the melt season. So maybe the first year we'll have no sea ice for September, and then it will grow back in the winter. Maybe within a few years we'll be gone for August, September, October, and it'll grow back in the winter. And then a few years after that, add another month on either end, completely open ocean, July, August, September, October, November, and then it'll grow back. So we're playing with fire here. I mean, we're going to get, you know, I'm already, you know, greatly concerned because the CO2 rise in the atmosphere was 3 parts per million last year and the year before. Meanwhile, the International Energy Agency said that humans' emissions have stabilized, you know, in the last 5 years or so. So if human emissions have stabilized, levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are continuing to rise at record rates, it means that there's already less CO2 being either absorbed in the oceans or absorbed or taken up in forests and plants and stuff. So there's more in the atmosphere and oceans, even though we're emitting less. And it's very, very like, in fact, it's we're going to lose the ability to do anything about climate change if we wait much longer.
Okay, we only have 10 minutes left, and let's go to another caller. Suzanne, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Suzanne, and we are all humans. Whether we, you know, are janitors, school teachers, or chemists, whatever. I happen to be one of those. But I go way beyond that definition. So that's the first place, is that we are talking about accept no models by politicians or fundamental religionists, because the first question is, what are your credentials? You know, why are you talking about something and you can't tell me what the terms that you gentlemen have just been using?
We only have a couple minutes left here.
I'm going to say 3 things about our current society. One is that it has a very short attention span because of all the graphics and the gadgets. Watch TV, you know, do your cell phone and all that. And then there's a very naive belief that if it is on your cell phone, the TV or whatever, it's true.
Okay, but we have Paul Beckwith for a very short amount of time on the issue of the methane and climate change.
Yes, I agree.
Get some money, put it into a day-to-day graphic broadcast on TV and whatever, whether you use cartoons or whatever. Keep hitting hard day by day.
Yes, we need this. We need the mainstream media to recognize that the risk from climate change is enormous. And we need them to tune their attention to this on a regular basis and have day-to-day stuff. I mean, right now, you know, we see day-to-day information on, you know, on the Middle East, you know, on Syria, on Iraq, on...
The kid
whatever.
Cartoon thing works. Do it. It's simple. You don't have to be disloyal to science, but for heaven's sake, be fast and don't be boring. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. Let's go to our next caller, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a couple of questions. I was wanting to know if Paul thought whether or not human societies would do enough quickly enough to stem the tide of climate change. And I was also wondering what his thoughts are on Guy McPherson's work and the growing near-term human extinction movement.
Yes. So will humans be able to do enough to turn the tide? There's a lot of... I think that, you know, we don't know for sure the answer to that question. I think that we have to... You know, I don't think that the answer to that question should stop us from taking every action possible to address, try to stem the tide of climate change. That includes slashing fossil fuel emissions by, you know, even ramping up. We need to declare a climate change emergency. We need to slash fossil fuels much faster than
I totally understand that. I'm wondering what
we need to do. Yeah. So I think that, you know, if we just continue business as usual and ignore the problem, we're going to rocket up to a much warmer world. And how ecosystems can deal with that, whether some of them can adapt and stuff, then, you know, this is a big question. And I don't know the answer. I don't think one can say definitively that humans are going to go extinct in a time period of, say, 10 years, or can say definitively that we won't. I mean, I think it's very unlikely that we would, but, you know, there's so many things about the climate system so many surprises and things that are happening. But I think we can take drastic action to cool the planet and to remove CO2 from the atmosphere and to slash our emissions. If we recognize that we're playing with fire, literally. I mean,
okay,
politicians and humans will do that.
Well, I see. This is my example is always the military says climate change is an existential threat, and it's a threat multiplier. It affects everything. So if they take that to if that gets widespread public acceptance that we have this enormous risk from climate change, then let's use all the resources that we have to address, to throw at the problem. And that includes military budgets. So if things like that are done, I'd say we have a fighting chance. If things deteriorate and humans can't even talk to each other and wars over resources break out across the planet, then I don't think we have a fighting chance. But, you know, how many people are left after the end of it all? That's, you know, an open question. And I think that should start being debated in public spheres, not, you know, in fringe groups. I mean, look, we have people, you know, 1% or 0.1% or people are buying places in areas where they think climate change will do the least damage. So they're starting to get worried about, you know, they're trying to get their, like, this is happening big time, apparently. You know, I've read a number of articles on this now. So, like, what's going on? Like, you know, I mean, what about putting resources into trying to deal with the problem? And we can't keep having an exponential population growth on the planet.
Okay, Mark, why don't you give your last thought, and then we go to another caller.
Yeah, I guess, given that the Department of Defense is putting out a position paper on this, I'm a social scientist. I just don't see us adapting quickly enough given the political forces at work. And I'm not sure governments that are aware of what's happening are even willing to tell the public.
It looks dire. It looks very, very dire now, but I don't think, I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet.
And I'm not suggesting we throw in the towel either. I think we should do everything we can, but...
Okay, thank you for calling. I just want to, before we go to our last caller, David, I believe, before we go to him, just give us I know this is kind of absurd, you only have 5 minutes. Just give us one idea about, say, cooling the Arctic. I know we talked extensively a year ago. People can refer to that program, and I'll link to that again on this page, kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. Where you can get all my shows. You talked about various strategies, the three-leg stool, carbon drawdown, geoengineering, and masking, solar masking, and shutting down fossil fuels. Give us one like idea that people haven't maybe thought of that if, for example, the military budgets were redeployed on a World War II mobilization scale, which people are talking about, and it's obviously not happening, is going in the other direction. One thing that could give people the idea that actually this methane bomb might not go off.
Yeah. So the idea of the military thing, you know, putting all those resources into it, you know, it's not happening, but who's to say it's not going to happen when we have the first blue ocean event with no ice in the Arctic, and the extreme weather events, the floods and stuff, go up in the order of magnitude, and they're far worse, and are basically taking out cities here and there. You know, who's to say that those military resources?
But isn't it too late at that point?
Well, what does too late mean, right? I would argue that, you know, as long as there's people living on the planet, it's not too late. You know, too late is just too broad a term. It's too late for many people.
Well, you know what I mean?
Near sea level is too late.
I mean very specifically, though, doesn't the technology that you're possibly talking about to take carbon or methane out of the atmosphere or whatever, doesn't it already have to have been developed? Like, doesn't it, or don't we have to be in the phase?
Right. Okay, so if we wanted to cool the planet a degree Celsius, we could do it. We could do it probably in a few months or 6 months. Okay, we could cool the planet. We have the technology. We know it will work. It's the only one that works that I know of is putting sulfur into the stratosphere. Okay, if we put sulfur in jet aircraft engines and we put it up in the stratosphere, or we deploy it some other way up in the stratosphere, we can cool the planet for 3 to 5 years, a degree Celsius, or even more if we wanted, or half a degree Celsius. We could tailor it. And this happens naturally when a big volcano goes off and puts sulfur into the upper atmosphere. It's like putting little tiny mirrors which reflect light, and there's less light going to the surface of the Earth, and it causes cooling. Okay, so, you know, if we're going to have billions, we're talking about total disruption and chaos and billions of deaths on the planet, you know, we can do technologies like this. Hopefully, you know, we can phase in things and we don't reach that situation where we have total collapse of food supply and things like that. You know, when we get the first blue ocean event, maybe that will wake up people like the military and so on. I don't think they're asleep necessarily. I think one of the problems is they don't know what to do, right? So if they just tell people, hey, the situation's awful, it's terrible, you know, will there be panic? Will people stop going to work? And will it totally destroy the economy just because of, you know, but people won't believe that. Well, would they believe it coming from the military? I don't know. I mean, there's so many human impacts here that can affect it either way, so I don't know. But you know, more benign technologies are brightening clouds in the Arctic, marine cloud brightening. That would cool the Arctic. You know, you're just spraying seawater up there. You know, salt particles go up, create clouds that are whiter and cool the Arctic. So, but the last ditch sort of thing is the sulfur blanket over the planet to cool.
These are probably the ideas we should have started talking about 20 minutes ago to have a fuller discussion. We'll be good if we could get you back on and perhaps some others.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you who else is really talking about this stuff. But we really don't have time. Give us a couple other, you know, who else do you think is really dealing with this stuff in a serious way?
Well, who else is dealing with this in a serious way? I think that the military is dealing with this in a serious way. I think the U.S. military is, but you know, we're not privy to any of that information. I think you know, Peter Wadhams is in the United Kingdom is the ice expert, the Arctic ice expert. And
okay, I got to cut you off because we got to go. But that book Drawdown is the one you mentioned.
Yeah, Drawdown. Yeah, start with that book.
By Paul Hawken. Another Paul, three Pauls. Okay, thank you so much, Paul Beckwith, climate system scientist. Really appreciate and hope to get you back on again.
Yes.
Oh, and your website is paulbeckwith.net.
Yes, paulbeckwith.net, and I have hundreds of YouTube videos talking about everything.
Yes, thank you so much.
Go to my YouTube channel. Yeah.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks. Goodbye, thanks.